This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Former First Lady Barbara Bush has written her memoirs. It's made news for revealing that she disagrees with her husband on abortion. Earlier today, we spoke about that disagreement and talked about her family life and her years as a public figure. We started at the very beginning with her childhood.
Well, I grew up in Rye, New York. I had a wonderful mother and father and two brothers and one sister. It was a town of 8,000 people, and it was a wonderful little town.
Now, your father became the publisher of McCall's and Red Book. Did you read those magazines when you were growing up?
Yes, I did read them. He worked all of his working life, really, in that particular business, and I did read them when I was growing up. They were not quite the same as they are now.
What were they like?
Well, they were more women's magazines and sort of genteel kind of stories.
And how did they affect your sense of what it would mean to become an adult?
Not very much. My father also was the president and the CEO of the McCall Corporation, and they printed the McCall patterns. And that affected my childhood because we used to play dolls with them. He'd bring home the old catalogs, and we loved that.
Tell me something about your mother.
Well, my mother was very beautiful. She was a gardener. She had very little sense of humor. She made the world more beautiful, really. She did beautiful needlepoint. She was a wonderful... She ran a wonderful house. She had a lot of worries as a young woman, really, or a young mother, because we had a brother that was very ill, and she was a wonderful person.
Was this the brother? Oh, your brother was
My brother was very ill.
Oh.
He's fine. Mm-hmm. He's great now. But it was 5 years of a lot of worry, and I don't think I realized as a child how hard that is on a mother.
You singled out the fact that your mother had very little sense of humor. Is that something you noticed as a child?
Well, I noticed it more as I grew older. She just did not. And I think everybody agreed she had very little sense of humor. But she had a great sense of beauty, and she certainly was a good, loving mother.
What did your brother have?
Well, he had a cyst in his arm, and they took chips from different parts of his body, bone chips, and put them into the arm. And we were never really told exactly what he had. But it took, after five very serious operations, it worked. And the chips grew, and he grew to be a wonderful, strong, loving, very athletic man.
When you were a girl, what were your fantasies about what you wanted to be as a woman, what you wanted your life to be like when you grew up?
I guess, like my mother's, I don't know. We just had a wonderful, very healthy outdoor childhood, and I think I had an older sister, and I guess I wanted to copy her and copy my mother. I later decided that I'd like to be a nurse. But then I met that marvelous George Bush, and the nursing went out the window.
How did you meet your husband, George Bush?
I met him at a dance in Greenwich, Connecticut, when I was 16. And he asked someone to introduce me to him, and we then became friends.
Were you a good dancer? Did you feel that this was a comfortable way to meet a boy?
Well, I was a good dancer. He was not a good dancer. And that's really how... In those days, you know, you went to a dance with either... You just went, or you went with a boy. But he did not expect to dance with you all night. You expected to dance with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And one... George did dance with me, and then they suddenly started to play a waltz, and George said, "Do you mind if we sit down, because I don't know how to waltz?" And we did sit down and talk, and he came to a party he knew I was going to be attending the next night, and sort of went on from there. I ought to tell you, read the book. It's in the book.
My guest is Barbara Bush, and she's just written her memoirs. No, I think... when you met, you were 16, he was 17, you were married 3 years later.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pilot in the war then.
Mm-hmm.
Did the war affect your feelings of urgency about getting married?
Absolutely. I know that my family and his would not have approved of our getting married at 19 and 20 if it hadn't been for the war and we knew he was going back overseas.
Your husband was in the oil business before entering politics, and I've read that you moved at least 11 times in the first 6 years of marriage, and he had to travel a lot, and you often had to manage the family alone. What were those years like for you? What were some of the stresses that you faced?
Well, for 20 years, George was in business, and we did move a lot, but we settled down in Midland, Texas, and the same stresses everybody whose husband has a job out of town face. I mean, some of my children are going through that now. You have to be mother and father sometimes. But you forget those times. I remember thinking at times, they're wonderful children. They're beautiful and they're brilliant. But they haven't said one thing that makes them fascinating all week long. I want to talk to adults. Well, every mother feels that. But it's worth it. I mean, take the time to talk to them and read to them and help them grow up. And it's worth it. They're now the world's greatest living humans, so I guess it was fine.
Your second child, Robin, was diagnosed with leukemia when she was 3, and she died just a few months later. You write in your memoirs that the doctor said, "This is the advice I would give you. Don't tell anyone she's sick. Don't even try to treat her. Just take her home, make her as comfortable as you can, and let her gently slip away, and she'll probably die within 3 weeks." Mm-hmm. How did that advice sound at the time to you?
Well, it sounds just the way it sounds now. Probably was true, but you couldn't do that. You always hope there'll be a cure. And today that wouldn't happen. There has been a semi-cure for leukemia, really. So it was worth trying. It was hard on her, and it was certainly hard on George, who had to keep on in business and work, and it was hard on me and our family. But on the other hand, if you ever give up hope, you give up living.
Did you become more nervous about the health of your other children after losing one?
That's a good question. I haven't been asked that for a long time, but I do remember when one of the children, or two of them, had their tonsils out. Someone saying to me, "Oh, well, after what you've been through, tonsils are nothing." And I said, "Well, after what I've been through, tonsils are worse than ever." I mean, I think everything becomes more valuable, and your children's health, which you used to take for granted, suddenly becomes very tentative. But I got over being quite so nervous about them.
Was it hard to find the balance between being protective and overly protective?
Yes, and thank heavens for George Bush, because he believes in independence, and he always gave the children independence, and he would trust them. And when I would maybe think they were more like me, that they shouldn't be trusted or something, he would say, "Of course they can drive across the country when they're 16. They have their license." I would panic, but they did it, and they're great kids.
There's one of the difficult parts of your life, according to your memoirs, was around 1975 when your husband became the head of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And you described that period as a period in which you were very depressed, lonely, and unhappy. And I just want to read a paragraph from your new memoirs. You write, "It is still not easy to talk about today, and I certainly didn't talk about it then. I felt ashamed. I had a husband whom I adored, the world's greatest children, more friends than I could see, and I was severely depressed. I hid it from everyone, including my closest friends, everyone but George Bush. He would suggest that I get professional help, and that sent me into deeper gloom. He was working such incredibly long hours at his job, and I swore to myself that I would not burden him. Then he would come home, and I would tell him all about it. Night after night, George held me weeping in his arms while I tried to explain my feelings. I almost wonder why he didn't leave me. Sometimes the pain was so great, I felt the urge to drive into a tree or an oncoming car. When that happened, I would pull over to the side of the road until I felt okay." Looking back on that period of your life, what do you think caused that incredible depression?
I'm pretty sure I know what caused it now. Stupidity on my part. But I think I was going through maybe menopause, and our children were gone for the first time, and it had been the first time that George had had a job in a number of years that I really couldn't share in, because I can't keep a secret. I still can't keep a secret. But having said that, I think all those things combined gave me that sort of really deep depression. But now there's a positive side to this story. I'm glad it happened now, although there was a physical pain then that went with it, and it wasn't very, it was an awful time. But having said that, I now am much more sympathetic to people who have problems, and I really feel free to say to people, get help. There's help out there. My doctor, when I told him later and said, why didn't you help me? He said, well, why didn't you tell me? And I was embarrassed, and I just thought that my code said you ought to be strong and you can overcome things if you just think of others. Well, I think that's partially true, but I also think that there's, you can get chemical help that will help you over difficult times.
How'd you snap out of it?
I guess I outgrew it. I was lucky, and I'm very grateful for that. But I think it was, I still think it was good for me because I'm much more sympathetic to other people.
Let me ask you this. When he'd come home at night and you were crying.
Well, I wasn't crying all the time.
Okay, but you know, here's this question. Did you ever feel like, oh, God, he's got, you know, the world's secrets resting on his shoulders, and here
yes.
I am unhappy, and I'm taking up his time,
yes.
and that's bad for the United States of America?
No, I thought it was bad for just anyone to do that. I thought it was, no, I did, I felt selfish, and you see, that's sort of against my code. I may be selfish, but it's against my beliefs to think. I think you ought to try to think of others.
What else is in your code?
Well, decency and honesty, I hope, and all those nice things. But thinking of others, doing unto others, those are sort of in my code.
At the time of this depression, or I guess shortly afterwards, you told One Magazine that you thought it was because of the women's movement, because the women's movement had made you think your life had been wasted.
Well, I thought that was a fourth ingredient into it, beside the no sharing in the job, the children gone, the menopause. I thought the women's movement at that time, it isn't so true anymore, sort of made women who stayed at home feel inadequate. I'm thinking that women who stay at home and raise their children are doing the most important thing they can do for them, their country.
Well, what do you think now?
I think
have
that
been,
now.
No, I mean, what do you think now have been the pros and cons of the women's movement?
Well, I think there have been lots of pros. I mean, equal pay for equal work is very, very important. And there's a lot of self-esteem that goes into that. But I also think that priorities should be your children. If you opt to have children, you ought to take care of them.
Barbara Bush is my guest. She's written her memoirs. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with former First Lady Barbara Bush. When your husband started his 1988 presidential campaign, you wrote in your diary one day that you knew he was the most qualified, but you didn't want him to run. What were your fears then about the campaign and the life that would follow if he became president and you became first lady?
Well, that was just what I felt one day. I mean, you know, a diary is what you feel at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
It is not necessarily what you feel all the time.
But on those days when you had doubts, what were they?
Well, it just, the campaigning gets so ugly. And it's just some days you're just too tired to face all that. And maybe that's what I felt. I can't really remember the day you're talking about,
okay.
But I'm sure I wrote it. But I, when I wrote the book, I thought I ought to put in it every feeling because I'm trying to be honest.
What were your feelings about the emphasis on family values in your husband's campaign?
Well, they were right. You see signs now that say Dan Quayle was right, bumper stickers all around. Democrats are now pushing us over saying family values are important. He was right. George had a group of mayors come visit in his office when he was president, headed by Mayor Bradley of Los Angeles, and then some Republicans, some Democrats, big and little cities, and they all agreed on one thing only. The breakup of the American family, what was causing most problems in all their cities, that drugs and crime, school dropouts, teenage pregnancies, all those things go back to the breakup of the American family. Now, George didn't make that up. The mayors did. But that just reinforced what you and I know is true, that we may have different families now, different setups, but family is what's important, whether they're friends or it's just important. Every child deserves to have someone know their name.
I think in a way you just put your finger on something, which is that there's different kinds of families, and I think
that's a
lot of the debate was over what family values means and who's defining what a family is.
Well, you and I, we may not be able to define it, but we know what it is. We've got to get back to caring for our children.
Marilyn Quayle at the Republican convention said, most women do not wish to be liberated from their essential natures as women.
Never understood what that meant.
Uh-huh. Did you talk to her about that?
No. I heard it, but I didn't quite understand what that meant. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's true. But anyway, I don't understand what it meant, tell you the honest truth.
What the essential nature of women means?
Well, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she'd gone on to say, most of us love being wives and mothers, which gives our lives a richness that few men or women get from professional accomplishments.
Well, I don't agree with that, but that's what she thought, and that's fine. But I think the perception of what she was saying sounded sort of unlike Marilyn. She's a very warm, good mother, and she's someone
who's worked a lot, too. She's a lawyer.
Very bright woman. And she wanted to work, you know, but the job kept her from doing that, really.
No, it's interesting. I mean, although, you know, you dropped out of college to get married and raise your family, you've ended up having an incredible working life yourself. You were very prominent, especially in your role as First Lady, and you worked incredibly hard, both for your husband's campaigns, but also for literacy and other issues you took on. And I guess I'm wondering if you would have felt comfortable working that hard in a field that was separate from your husband, or if you only felt that you could allow yourself to spend that much time on a public life and a working life, knowing that it was really supporting your husband.
No, I wouldn't have been comfortable as the wife of the president, the vice president, working in another career. But then that would have been my choice. I'm not saying that it isn't something people should do, but I would not have been comfortable there. But I did work, I want to correct you a little bit, but I worked very hard all during the vice president's years when my children were gone, for literacy then too. I mean, I've been in the business now about 15 years, and I would not have been comfortable working for a living. But as a young mother, if my husband and I needed me to work, I wouldn't have been uncomfortable about that at all.
Barbara Bush is my guest. She's just written her memoirs. Now, as First Lady, you intentionally chose something very important and also very not controversial, literacy.
Well, but I chose the most important thing, I believe, and I've grown steadily to believe it's the most important cause I could have chosen.
Well,
education.
It's a very important cause.
The most.
But I'm wondering how important it was for you to choose something that wasn't controversial, too.
Well, not important to anyone but me. I mean, I wanted to choose something that would help the most people possible, would not necessarily cost more government money, and would not be controversial, because in my opinion, when you run for high office, you need a wife or a husband who, rather like Dennis Thatcher, will help you, not hurt you. And I felt that that would not hurt George, but would help the most Americans possible. And in honesty, not necessarily need more government money. Most literacy programs are done by volunteers or through state programs.
What about the social causes that are behind the huge illiteracy rate? How did you feel like that should be taken into account?
If more people could read, write, and comprehend, we would have less people on the welfare rolls. We'd have less people. I mean, it just everything I worried about came back to that. Hunger, homeless, unemployed, pregnant teenagers, and I worried about a lot of things and still do. You just check those lists and you'll find that there's a disproportionate number of people who have not been taught to read.
It's a chicken and egg thing. You know, the other way of looking at it is that the more people that are poor, the more people that are on welfare, the more people that feel born into lives of hopelessness, the more literacy there's going to be. Illiteracy,
I mean, all right, but are you going to stand back on semantics, or are we going to try to do something about it? I'm trying to do something about it.
I guess, did you ever feel like that was... that some Republican policies of the 80s worked at cross purposes in the sense
of cutting back
certain social programs.
No, I did not, because I am absolutely dead convinced if you want it done wrong, let the federal government do it. That the states, we should put things back to the states and back to the cities. And we're taking too much money to the federal government and too little. Their job really should be to defend us.
Barbara Bush is my guest. She's just written her memoirs. I'm interested in hearing your response to Hillary Clinton's definition of her role as First Lady. I mean, she's taken on a policy issue that's been in the center of controversy right from the jump. Do you think that's an appropriate role for the First Lady?
Sure, if she wants to take it on. I mean, folks have different strokes or whatever that is. But yes, I have no criticism of her. You know, she's not the only First Lady who ever took on causes. Eleanor Roosevelt certainly was much more visible, much more in the public, really, than Hillary Clinton. And she took a big beating for it, too. But, I mean, each one does their own thing and does it their own way.
Did you have any role models, First Lady role models?
Well, I was always devoted to Lady Bird Johnson. And
a Democrat.
Well, that's right. I like her personally very, very much. I was very fond of, I don't know about role models, but very fond of Pat Nixon. I'm so old that I know that everybody does things their own way. And so I didn't have any feeling of, I've got to follow so-and-so or do like so-and-so. I did my own thing, and I immodestly think I did it very well. I raised public awareness of illiteracy, and I certainly raised millions of dollars for illiteracy, and I worked very hard to make our country more literate. We got the first literacy bill passed, thanks to George Bush, in 1991, and I mean, I worked hard on that.
Barbara Bush. She's written her memoirs. Barbara Bush will be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Barbara Bush. The former First Lady has just written her memoirs. In your memoir, you write a bit about abortion, and you say that you don't like abortions, but you think a woman should have the right to make that decision for herself. How did you reach that conclusion?
This is how I reached the conclusion. I agree with George Bush 99% of the way. And, he and I both believe that abortion is permissible when you have rape, incest, and the life of the mother at stake. We both agree, at least I agree, the first trimester only. I do not agree. Some states allow abortions up to the third trimester. I do not agree with that. We both think you should have parental consent. We believe that's very important. We both believe very, very strongly that education is the answer, that we should be educating our children. And this is a little off the subject. I'll get back to your question in a minute. But I am so offended when I keep hearing that schools should take the place of mothers and fathers and ministers, and we expect our teachers to do almost everything but teach, and then we criticize them for not having the time to teach. My own feeling is that mothers and fathers should be talking to their children about sex and about preventatives. I just think we should be saying to our children early and listening to them that sex is something you save for later. It's very important. It's dangerous, and you can have babies, and we shouldn't expect the schools to do that. Now, how did I get to that conclusion?
Yeah, thank you.
Well, when push comes to shove, I myself would never have an abortion. But having said that, I can't make that judgment for someone else. So that's how I feel. But we both agree that 1.6 million abortions a year is absolutely outrageous, and we're doing a lousy job educating our children.
So in these rare circumstances, when you found yourself disagreeing with your husband on something, would you try to change his mind, or would you just accept the fact that you'll disagree on this one?
We talked, like I hope other healthy marriages, and then we agreed to disagree. We never argued. We never fought about it. We both gave our opinions. And that was that.
So when you when your husband was president, mm-hmm. and you disagreed with him on something, mm-hmm. what did you see as your job in terms of either going public with an opinion or making sure no one found out about
it? My job, I'm not sure it was my job, but my belief is that unless you're courageous enough to run for office yourself, you can tell your husband or your wife what you think quietly in your own private time, and then you present a united front, and I believe in that. If I had run for office, I would hope George would pay me the same courtesy.
Well, did that sometimes put you in uncomfortable situations where people would assume you supported something like the Republican platform on abortion when you didn't?
No, because I really don't think the platform, party platform, matters. That is not a good thing to say, but I can't remember a word the Democrats said. I can't remember a word the Republicans said. I think platforms are should be very broad-based and inclusive, not exclusive. So I can't ever remember a campaign where I ran on a platform.
But still people associated the Republican Party at the presidential level with a strong anti-abortion mm-hmm. stand. So
did it never came up, and it never came up in a campaign, truthfully.
Abortion?
No, the platform.
No, but forgetting the platform a second, abortion came up a lot, and I'm just wondering if you ever felt very uncomfortable knowing that what
no,
you believe
No, because
is...
I'm 99% with George Bush on mm-hmm, that. Mm-hmm. It did not. I really think it's not a political. It should not be a political thing. I'm uncomfortable talking about it only because I really don't think we should be spending so much time. You know, nobody cares about it truthfully in politics.
But the point was, it became a political thing during that campaign.
Mm-hmm. I know it. Every campaign, I've never been to one that didn't have it. Seriously.
So, just to sum up, you weren't terribly uncomfortable by having that particular.
No, I'm not going to get uncomfortable for you because we agree in on almost okay. not just abortion. We have been married so long that I agree with George Bush on darn near 100% of everything. And the two or little things I didn't agree with him on made no difference. They weren't my top priority. My top priority is literacy. My top priority is a strong country. I mean, they're just that I think literacy will make us. If we can teach our children to read, write, and comprehend, we'll have less teenage pregnancies, we'll have less people seeking abortions, we'll have less drugs, we'll have a more educated workforce, we'll have 85% of our people in prison are functionally illiterate.
When you mentioned the two things that you disagreed with your husband about, is the other one you're referring to gun control of semi-automatic weapons?
Yes. I mean, I'm not even sure I think he's against semi-automatic weapons being, but it doesn't even matter now. Who cares what he or I are for? We're out of the business.
Are you glad to be able to say that?
Yes, I am.
Barbara Bush is my guest. The former First Lady has written her memoirs. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Barbara Bush. When you became First Lady, or when your husband first started running for president, mm-hmm. you know, image is so important in American politics today. Were there ever any attempts at quote, makeovers for you?
Well, you've read the book, I can tell. There were a few, but George always said, you're great the way you are. Don't try to change. And, you know, as a little girl, my dad used to say all the time, remember, he used to embarrass me to death and say it as I'd go out the door maybe with a date. It's nice to be natural, and you're naturally nice. And I wanted to kill him because I was hoping to impress someone with how sophisticated I was. But having said that, that's probably true. I decided that I would not, after a little struggle, that I would not try to be something I wasn't.
Was there a period when you did try to be something that you weren't?
Well, I dyed my hair for years. I was white-headed when I was in my 30s, and I dyed my hair for a number of years. But I gave that up. But I try to be neat and clean, look nice.
You know, Mary Madeline, in her memoirs, you know, co-written with James Carville, she writes about you, "You can never be bad or rude in Barbara Bush's presence. She makes you have better posture."
Oh, good. I loved her book, incidentally. I thought it was a lovely love story. I saw her before I read the book and told her I'm going to read hers, not his. But I do love the book.
So what did you think when she said she makes you have better posture?
I thought that was wonderful, and I'm going to be around her a lot.
Now, how do you feel about your sons going into politics after living this life yourself? You've seen what's good about it, what's difficult about it. A lot of people don't wish their professions on their children because they've seen so much of the hardships from it.
We didn't wish this on our children. These are two grown-up men, both of whom worked very hard in the private sector, have been fairly successful, have raised good families, and I can't tell you how proud it makes me feel of them. And it sort of vindicates, because they both worked very hard in the campaign. They both saw how ugly it can get, and yet they both still wanted to serve their country in this way. And I really feel as though I'm so proud of them, I can't believe it.
During the last presidential campaign, there was a lot of investigation or a lot of allegations about both your husband and Bill Clinton.
Don't put them in the same breath, please.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, one is a rumor and one were allegations. I mean, rumors happen in every campaign. They've happened in every campaign we've ever had. But it's very different.
So we're talking about the same thing here, which is...
We're talking about different things.
No, what I mean is the subject we're referring to is the same, affairs.
Yes.
The rumors about affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Is this, do you think, an appropriate subject for the press to investigate? Where would you draw the line about what you thought was fair and unfair?
Well, I think you can't control someone who stands up and says someone attacked me or someone did something to me, rather than just passing rumors that were... never happened and never were around. I think that's a big difference. But having said that, there are always in campaigns ugly things. And it's. Let's hope they'll stop unless you can prove them. But to reprint something that was never, that never happened, was looked into forever and never ever happened, is crazy. And it's unfair.
So you're saying that you thought there was more credence in the Bill Clinton story?
I didn't say that.
Okay, you were saying
two women stood up and said that.
You were saying don't say this in the same breath. So I'm
well, I feel that way. I mean, two women stood up and accused him of something. I can't do anything about that. But this was just ugly. There's a difference. And let's not talk about it anymore. It didn't happen, and I don't want to talk about it. It's just a rumor, and you and I are perpetuating something that isn't true.
Can I ask you what kind of report card so far you would give Bill and Hillary Clinton?
No, I think, you know, one thing is when you're president, you have a very hard job, and there's a loyal opposition out there that can give report cards. George and I have sort of taken the vow that we're not going to make their life more difficult.
And why did you take that vow?
Because it's a hard job, and that we've done our part. Now, give someone else a turn. There's loyal opposition. Bob Dole does a great job, and there are others out there who can make the report cards.
So many articles about you have mentioned that your pearls, which you so often wear, are fake pearls.
Really?
Have you ever noticed how many times that's mentioned?
I thought they were real.
Yes, right.
Darn it.
So is this intentional that... you're not wearing real pearls?
Do you know how much real pearls this size would cost?
Uh-huh.
And besides that, my head would be cut off to get them. But...
you have the money to buy it, right?
No. Nobody could buy my pearls. And I wouldn't want them if they were real. They're sort of fun. And besides that, they're big enough to cover my wrinkles.
I have one last question for you. It seems to me that you are... a very strong person with a very firm sense of when to say yes and when to say no.
Oh, I hope so.
And it, with the press, too, of when to say, we've spoken about this a lot, I don't care to answer that. And I wonder if you, where you feel you developed the sense of that. I know one of the things that a lot of professional women say is that one of the hardest things for them has been learning how to say no, because so many women they feel grew up in a time when they were socialized to be accommodating and to say yes and to want to be liked. And then you get to a point professionally where it's not about being liked, it's about making the right choices and about saying no when it's time to say no. Was that a hard thing for you to learn?
That's the funniest question I ever heard. But the truth is, my mother told me, say no.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Barbara Bush, she's written her memoirs. This is Fresh Air.